sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is journalist and author David Gregory, former moderator of Meet the Press, and the author of the new book, How's Your Faith? We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Spring has sprung very early here in the great Southwest where I live. And while we're grateful for the lovely weather, gentle breezes, and early buds and blossoms, we're also more than a little leery of what it will mean in the long run. Won't this guarantee an early and especially gruesomely hot and long summer? Isn't this further evidence of global warming? Sure, enjoy it now, but just wait. A serious price will be paid. In this way, we desert residents are all Jewish. We find it hard to enjoy our current good fortune for fear that we will ultimately suffer in the huge heat of the coming summer. We know from past experience that our fate is to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous bad fortune, or at least the long searing oven of the endless summer. And so living here can be a bit like the old joke about the Jewish telegram. Start worrying. Details to follow. That habit of worrying, of being unable to enjoy the good present out of fear for the anticipated disastrous future, is very Jewish indeed. And unlike the dwellers of our Sonoran desert, who enjoy 8 months or so of wonderful weather as the price for the 4 torrid months of summer, we Jews have rarely had many seasons of pure delight in our whole history. Our congenital insecurity comes in part out of our long experience of persecution and suffering. Nowadays, even when there really isn't anything immediately catastrophic on the horizon, this practice has become so deeply ingrained that we start the worrying when there really is nothing so terrible to worry about. I even heard someone say at a Jewish event recently, worrying about reports of rising anti-Semitism in France and Hungary, in England and Greece, "This is the worst time in history for Jews in Europe." And I thought, really? This is worse than the Holocaust? The Crusades? The pogroms? The Inquisition? This is the most dangerous, worst time in history for Jews in Europe? Well, in truth, things are not genuinely so bad for Jews today, not here in America, not in Israel, not even in Europe. It's not that there aren't problems out there. There are always problems out there for Jews, and there will always be people who don't share our values or views or even give us basic respect, those who truly wish to hurt us just because we are Jews. But generally speaking, it's a pretty good time to be Jewish. In fact, you can make an excellent case that this is among the very best times in all of history to be Jewish, which is something to celebrate. And to play us in on this lovely spring morning in Arizona on the theme of happiness and joy, here's a composition by my old friend Bob Bremstein, Ki Simachtani, taken from the Psalms. You have gladdened me by your deeds, God. I rejoice in your handiwork.
Ki Simachtani Adonai Mevolecha B'mase Yadecha Anane. Ki Simachtani gladden me by your deeds, Adonai, Adonai. I shout for joy at your handiwork, Adonai. simchtani Adonai befo'alecha b'maseh yadecha araneh. Ki simchtani Adonai befo'alecha b'maseh yadecha araneh. Ki simchtani Adonai befo'alecha b'maseh yadecha araneh. Ki simchtani Adonai befo'alecha b'maseh yadecha araneh. Yadecha araneh.
That was Chazan Allison Wissant singing Ki Simachtani by Bob Remstein. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, David Gregory, the outstanding journalist, former host of Meet the Press, will explain what led him to write his new book, How's Your Faith? Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. David Gregory is the former moderator of Meet the Press. He's served as chief White House correspondent for NBC News and is one of the most prominent American journalists. His new book is called How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
One of the items early on in your book kind of spurred you on this spiritual journey. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I think, for me, working in kind of the wilds of TV news, I think I came to a point where I was very successful in my career. I was covering the White House. I was really at a wonderful place. And I experienced a kind of spiritual longing. I think hitting a point where I was starting to ask myself the fundamental questions in life. You know, who am I? How should I live? What does it mean to be a person of faith? Indeed, what does it mean to be a Jew? And how do I find real meaning and purpose in that identity? And so that was happening not only out of a sense of kind of yearning, but because I was at an important place in my life. I had young children with my wife, Beth, who is Christian, who grew up in the Methodist church. And we were, as I think a lot of couples, especially interfaith couples, really thinking about, okay, if we're going to be on a Jewish path, what does it mean? She was challenging me to kind of dig deeper, to figure out how I was going to lead our family in faith. And I wanted to get it right. And so I think you know, in an industry that is not exactly conducive for the spiritual search, I found myself doing exactly that, digging deeper, asking bigger, more important questions in the middle of that.
Do you feel that you approach the spiritual search in a journalistic way? I was impressed in reading the book. You know, you went to see the Cardinal, you went to go meet with Joel Osteen, and you really approach this in a very different way than a lot of people who are on that spiritual journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think that no 2 days have been alike. I mean, I think in different periods, I had different approaches. I think at first, I approached it journalistically. I approached it critically. I thought, okay, I need to learn more. I mean, I think it was very Jewish in that sense, which is, let me kind of plunge into the sources. Let me begin to study. Let me learn. Let me try to seek some mastery over this discipline effect, over these texts, over this tradition. I think I started to understand that mastery really wasn't possible, right? And then from there, I also kind of experienced more spiritual yearning, more spiritual desire to connect with God and to have this be a pursuit of the heart and not just the head. And it was interesting. It's not just our, you know, particularly the Hasidic traditions within Judaism, but of course, wisdom from other traditions. It was Cardinal Dolan who said, you can make a mistake approaching this as too much of a project. Faith is really an act of love. It's a dare. It is, as he talked from the New Testament, the Gospel of Luke, you know, the disciples hearing from Jesus that, you know, they should cast deep into the waters despite their inability to catch any fish that day, but they should follow him, that they should dare to follow him and open their hearts to that potential. And so I would say this has moved from the head to the heart. Right now I'm much more in pursuit of a relationship with the divine that is about opening my heart and experiencing true kind of mystical spiritual connection.
We will talk much more with David Gregory. His book is called How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey, and about his own developed and continually developing Jewish identity. When we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco. People don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's 4 ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our 3 stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the Modest Cash Awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of 4 activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have about 8 months until we elect a new president of the United States, and we continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which chastised leading Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump for his lack of response when he was endorsed by the KKK leader David Duke a couple weeks ago, said this past week that anti-Semitic Islamic leader Louis Farrakhan has thrown his support behind the bombastic presidential hopeful. Nation of Islam leader Farrakhan delivered his statements in support of Trump during the 2016 Savior's Day sermon last Sunday at the Mariam Mosque in Chicago, which he also made a variety of anti-Semitic accusations of Jewish control of government. Trump's the only member who has stood in front of the Jewish community and said, "I don't want your money." Anytime a man can say to those who control the politics of America, "I don't want your money," that means you can't control me, and they cannot afford to give up control of the presidents of the United States, Farrakhan said in his sermon. Farrakhan later distanced himself from outright support of Trump, saying, "Not that I'm for Mr. Trump, but I like what I'm looking at." Farrakhan also blamed the Jewish people, whom he referred to as the Synagogue of Satan, his famous, infamous phrase, for provoking 9/11 and causing the Iraq War. Farrakhan defended his use of the phrase the Synagogue of Satan by discussing its origin in the Book of Revelations, saying, "Satan is a human being without human characteristics. That's why the Revelator called them beasts in human form," referring to Jews. "These are people sitting in the Pentagon planning the destruction of Muslim nations." Farrakhan alleged that former president of the World Bank Paul Wolfowitz and other government officials have been planning how they're going to clean out the Middle East and take over those Muslim nations. Now, them Jews got into the Bush administration, and on 9/11, the Twin Towers went down. George Bush and those devils, Satans around him, they plotted 9/11. Ain't no Muslim took control of no plane. Sick, as usual, from Farrakhan and full of lies, of course. Farrakhan, who has served as the minister of large mosques in Boston and Harlem, has been heavily criticized for his virulent and evil anti-Semitic and anti-white rhetoric. The ADL condemned Farrakhan's comments, adding him to the list of extremists who are throwing their support behind Donald Trump. Last week, former KKK leader David Duke told his followers that a vote for any candidate other than Trump was treason to your heritage. Trump did not distance himself from the KKK leader and anti-Semite, claiming he didn't know anything about Duke. Trump also did not condemn the endorsement by Duke or the statements made by Farrakhan in support of his campaign. Wow, David Duke and Louis Farrakhan both supporting Donald Trump. And that was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There's a recent change in the leadership of the Labour Party in Britain. They're not in power. It creates something called the shadow prime minister, the shadow foreign minister. The shadow prime minister now in England, and if the Labour Party won, he'd be the prime minister, is a very pro-Palestinian. He's been associated with meetings with Hamas and Hezbollah. This is not just sort of your garden variety. We don't like what Israel is doing. This is a kind of a different shift. This plays into fears people have about Europe becoming totally anti-Semitic and an unsafe place for Jews. Do you agree?
Well, I think there is a widespread perception among American Jews that Europe is deeply anti-Semitic, and a lot of people fail to make a distinction, and maybe it's a false distinction, I don't know, between being anti-Israel and being anti-Semitic. I think that there is a difference both historically and today. I think for some people, being anti-Israel is like a politically correct way to be a vicious anti-Semite. But I also think that for many people, including some Jews, you can question Israeli political decisions or Israeli actions without being anti-Israel on the one hand or anti-Semitic on the other. Certainly, it's hard to accuse most Jews of being anti-Semitic.
I mean, we do occasionally talk about self-hating Jews, but that's right. Not the main issue in Europe right now.
Right. I think what's going on in Western Europe is a result of several things. First of all, a large growth in the presence of Muslims in places where traditionally there were either no Muslim communities at all or very tiny ones. So Germany has had Turks for a long time, but other places like Denmark, Holland, England, whatever, the presence of significant Muslim communities is new, and the presence of so many Muslims who are articulate in the media, in your face, give interviews all the time, whatever, gives Muslims a chance to engage very actively in propaganda, which is often pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. At the same time, ever since the Yom Kippur War, and increasingly in the last couple of decades, Israel seems to have abandoned its own Hasbara, which is technically explanation, but propaganda efforts in Western Europe.
Public relations would be another way to explain.
Right, right. Israel used to be very, very active in precisely those parts of Europe that we're talking about, Northwestern Europe. And you'll remember that in the 60s and the very early 70s, lots of teenagers and graduate students from those countries went and volunteered and worked on Israeli kibbutzim and moshavim and all that. And they saw Israel as this progressive, humanitarian, sort of socialist country in the Middle East, and they loved it. And that was, in part, the fruit of Israel's efforts to cultivate a positive image. For whatever reason, it has largely abandoned those efforts in that part of the world.
We can talk about that next week, and also sort of what Europe's attitude towards Jews is today, where it comes from. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk
next week. I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan Israel, Oshrat Bar-El, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you're back from Israel not very long now, and we were talking about the perceptions that people have about Israel and how they think everything's about the Palestinian issue. But while you were there, there was an awful lot about a totally different Israeli issue, although it does relate in some ways, corruption. Which bakshish, I don't know the right term for it, but boy, it seemed, you know, first the former president, the former prime minister, Ehud Olmert, both went to prison finally in longstanding cases.
Shar Haotzar, yeah, the treasurer.
The treasurer. Is there anybody left in the Israeli government or past government who isn't in jail? It's a sign of a democracy that they can convict their highest officials of corruption, but it's also a little bit depressing, isn't it?
Definitely depressing, but, you know, it's a Sunday morning and I would like to be positive and I would like to focus on the first part of what you said. It's really a sign of a democracy because I don't think that it's the like only in this decade we have a lot of cases of corruption. I think we had it only with the former leaders, but it wasn't as strong a democracy as we want to think and believe. So no one convict the, you know, I don't want to mention names.
I don't want to mention anybody like Ariel Sharon or anything who was accused many times.
Not to mention Moshe Dayan, Chas v'Chalila, and others.
Lots of former, very prominent Israelis.
But I think it's a testimony for a strong democracy, but it's also depressing because, you know, at the end of the day, we live in a very, very intense, complex, whatever you want to call the situation in Israel, and you want to feel that you trust your leaders. And you can't have trust in someone who really, you know, use our money in not in the best ways, that like how you can trust it on other issues. So I think it's more an issue of a trust.
It's certainly, you know, we were talking about Ehud Olmert, who was a very effective politician. He was mayor of Jerusalem, a very effective prime minister.
He was one of the best prime ministers we had.
And he was always corrupt.
And he was brave.
He was brave.
Maybe
he was,
too brave.
He probably got closest to actual peace with the Palestinians of any prime minister in Israel's history. Mm-hmm. Willing to make compromises. He seemed to have partners to deal with. Mm-hmm. Everybody always knew he was on the take, okay? I mean, years ago when he was mayor of Jerusalem and his brother got all the contracts to construction. Everybody knew this for a long time. Was there maybe something about the timing of this being
revealed? Definitely. He grew up in the Likud. So for sure, no one expects someone that grew up in the Likud will be willing to give up, you know, parts of Jerusalem. That's how far he went in order to
Seek peace.
To see, yeah. So I think that as soon as they understand that, you know, he needed to be stopped in any way, and
they had plenty of skeletons.
Yeah,
to pull out
so
of the
they didn't, you know, didn't go far like with Rabin, but
yeah, they didn't shoot him.
They definitely had enough a different way to kill him, actually.
Yeah, politically, in this
definitely.
Sense. Well, it is a sign of a democracy that it finds a way to exorcise its problems, and we hope Israel gets cleaner, I think might be the best way to describe it. Of course, we don't have any corruption in America at all.
We're in a good situation as long as we have more members of the Knesset in the Knesset than in the jail.
Hopefully, we'll always be able to say that. Thanks, Ashrat. We'll talk next week.
Bye.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy, our maven on education. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or.
It is springtime. It's the most beautiful season of the year. Many places, certainly true here in the Southwest.
Yes.
It just starts earlier for us.
Yep.
The seasons of the year are important. Are there educational seasons?
You bet there are educational seasons. And, you know, one thing I've been really mindful lately is the seasons of life and how all of us grow and change throughout our lives. And how especially profound it is when we see that happening with kids. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the early stages of life and how they connect to school. In our environment, kids start at 5 years of age. So typical for kindergarten, first and second graders, as they start school, to have a very similar set of needs. We know through lots of studies of education, there are specific levels of learning and needs. And in psychology, there are the hierarchy from Maslow, which talk about things like physiological needs, the needs of an infant who sleeps at night, are different, if we're lucky, sleeping at night, are different from the needs of an adult who may or may not sleep at night.
Right.
So at the base of the pyramid of Maslow's hierarchy are physiological needs, sleep, food, water. And then second is a sense of safety. On top of that is love and belonging. And certainly with the younger age student, we see a different type of need in terms of feeling safe and feeling a sense of loving and belonging. And schools really work to accommodate those things. When you're in a primary age classroom, you'll see smaller furniture. There might be a sheltered playground that is specifically for the younger kids. Teachers will teach in a way that is developmentally appropriate to ensure that kids feel that they're safe, that they have that sense of love and belonging. And it applies not only to general education, but to Jewish learning as well. There was a gentleman by the name of Bloom who developed a taxonomy of learning and applying knowledge. And at the lowest level, we have basic knowledge of information. What are the primary colors, for example, in the younger grades? Basic ideas about numbers, days of the week, what things are called. So there's a knowledge base that's very strong in this area. Then we move up the taxonomy to comprehension and application. So as children build a foundation of knowledge, then they learn about what these things mean, and they develop their comprehension and their understanding of concepts. And then they get to apply the learning. And you see this in Jewish education, where learning is applied through active engagement in activities. It may be shaking the lulav and etrog at Sukkot. It may be preparing the Seder table and you're walking through the Seder itself with the different foods that we eat and other ceremonial elements. So Bloom's taxonomy, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, very much alive and part of what we do when we think of the developing child in the early years.
And maybe we'll talk about the differences and how those are applied at different ages next week. Thanks, John.
Absolutely. Thank you.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Toward Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th of 2016. If you want to come on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is sitting at a hotel bar waiting for his wife when an attractive woman approaches him. "Hi, honey," she says. "Want a little company?" "Why?" asks Moshe. "Do you have one to sell?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we finish reading the book of Exodus with the portion of Pekudei, which completes the work and dedication of the tabernacle, first central shrine of worship for Jews ever. The purpose of this place is a little unclear initially. After all, if God exists beyond time and space and has no physical manifestation at all, that is, if the Jewish idea of God is correct, then why does God need any kind of a fixed place of residence? Of course, the answer is that it isn't God that needs the tabernacle, or the temple in Jerusalem, or any sanctuary or chapel in any synagogue or temple anywhere in the world at any time in history. It's we who need that place. You see, human beings can think abstractly and say that we don't need rituals or rites, that we are much too sophisticated to require places for prayer or even to need to pray at all. But when we're alone or in pain, when we are lost, when our minds aren't dulled by television or email or the internet or other distractions, we find that we still have spiritual needs. And those needs are not abstract, but concrete. We need a place of solace and separation from the outside world, a location where we can seek God and our own best nature in serenity and peace. In short, we still need a temple, just as our ancestors did, for it is there that we find holiness in a world dedicated to the ordinary. You can, of course, pray anywhere. but having a place of beauty and specific sanctity built to give tribute to God can make all the difference. I think of the distinction between the huge office and hotel towers, often named after a company or an individual to glorify itself or himself, and the sacred spaces we construct to pay tribute to God. Usually the spiritual houses are much smaller than the financial or hospitality edifices, but they mean so much more. May our own houses of prayer serve as the great tent in the wilderness once did, to deepen our spirituality, to enhance the meaning of our lives. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, respected journalist and author David Gregory, former host of Meet the Press, will explore what led him on his journey of faith to a deep experience of Jewish life, prayer, and study. Find out when we return shortly here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A former Argentine spymaster accused the government of former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner of being responsible for the death of AMIA prosecutor Alberto Nisman, spurring a change of venue to a court that hears murder cases. Following 15 hours of testimony from Antonio Jaime Thiuso, former operations chief of the country's spy agency, Judge Fabiana Palmagini said the case will be investigated now by a federal court. Thiuso's testimony was not officially released because Palmagini placed a gag order on the investigation. But the Argentine media reported that Thiuso said Nisman's death was intimately linked with the complaint that he had made, accusing the Kirchner government of deciding to not incriminate former senior officials of Iran and trying to erase their roles in planning the bombing. Thiuso assisted Nisman in the investigation into the 1994 attack on the Buenos Aires Jewish Center, which left 85 dead and hundreds wounded. Iran is largely considered to be responsible for the act of anti-Semitic terrorism and murder. Nisman was found shot and killed in the bathroom of his apartment back on January 18th of 2015, but no official cause of death was presented. 10 hours after hearing Stiuso's testimony, Palmagini declared herself unfit to continue the case and changed the venue. She overturned her own ruling, saying there was no evidence indicating Nisman had been murdered. The judge lodged a complaint against prosecutor Viviana Fine for failing to register information, including data provided by Stiuso in his first testimony in the Nisman investigation, made over a year ago, February of 2015. The change of jurisdiction was requested less than a week ago by Ricardo Saenz, the Attorney General for Argentina's Criminal Appeals Court, who also asserts that Nisman was murdered. In a letter to the judges, Saenz wrote that a federal magistrate has the broadest jurisdiction to clarify which of all the assumptions into Nisman's death are correct. Nisman's body was found hours before he was about to present evidence to Argentine lawmakers that Kirchner covered up Iran's role in the Amiya murder attack. According to Stiuso, Nisman was killed, well, murdered, for not stopping the investigation as Kirchner had ordered. She decided to negotiate the pact with Iran and ordered the SI, that's the Secret Service, to stop providing evidence or information on the Amiya case, Stiuso testified. According to Palmagini, evidence at Nisman's apartment probably was tampered with before Fine's arrival at the scene, since 20 people, including former Security Secretary Sergio Berni, entered the apartment the night that Nisman's body was discovered. Addressing the first session of the National Argentine Parliament last week, President Mauricio Macri said, "Let's not forget that little more than a year ago, prosecutor Alberto Nisman turned up dead in circumstances that remain uncertain but are slowly starting to clear up. They seem to be. We will stay tuned to this crucial trial in Argentina." In other news, it was a week of awards for Jews. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of the British Commonwealth, won one of the world's largest prizes, the $1.5 million Templeton Prize, which recognizes individuals for contributions to life's spiritual dimensions. During his service as chief rabbi from 1991 to 2013, Sacks revitalized British Jewry. Rabbi Sacks promoted Jewish ethical responsibility and created organizations dedicated to fostering Jewish approaches to contemporary issues in business and in women's equality. "Today, the most powerful religious voices are coming from the extremes. I think that's terribly dangerous. They are speaking to young idealistic kids, turning them into murderers. We can't sit still and just let that happen," Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said. "I think religious leaders have to give the same power and passion to the forces of reconciliation, compassion, forgiveness, love, friendship, across the boundaries between faiths," Sacks added. He is the author of 25 books, most recently Not in God's Name, Confronting Religious Violence. Rabbi Sacks currently teaches Jewish thought at NYU and Yeshiva University. The Templeton Foundation praised Sacks' appreciation and respect of all faiths, with an emphasis that recognizing the values of each is the only path to effectively combat the global rise of violence and terrorism. Sacks will formally receive the Templeton, whose cash award is bigger than the Nobel Prize or the MacArthur Prize, at a May 26th ceremony in London. He has previously received the Jerusalem Prize and was knighted in 2005 by Queen Elizabeth. Previous winners of the Templeton Prize include South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. And last week at the Oscars, the Hungarian Holocaust film The Son of Saul won for Best Foreign Language Film. Story of a Sonderkommando's attempt to arrange a kosher burial of the body of what might be his illegitimate son is a fascinating and powerful tale and might be the best Holocaust movie ever made. Oddly, after his acceptance speech, the Son of Saul's Jewish director, Laszlo Nemes, was ushered off the stage with the playing of The Ride of the Valkyries, composed by the notoriously anti-Semitic German Richard Wagner.
In the darkest hours of mankind, there might be a voice within us that allows us to remain human. That's the hope of this film. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It was a poignant moment at the Oscars, followed by a bit of profound cognitive dissonance. Nevertheless, The Son of Saul is a powerful, disturbing, beautifully made film and well-deserving of the Oscar. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, David Gregory. He's the former moderator of NBC's Meet the Press. He appears regularly in a variety of journalistic contexts. His new book is called How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey. David, growing up, your dad was Jewish, your mom wasn't. You note in the book that your dad's idea of Jewish practice was to go on the high holidays and have a Passover Seder. That was pretty much it. What spurred you to decide, you know, your wife isn't Jewish, your mom wasn't Jewish. What urged you to
What spurred you to decide to sort of actualize your own Jewish identity?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. I've been studying recently about kind of the difference between, you know, whether we are Jews by choice or whether we are Jews by virtue of the fact that we are, you know, kind of a letter in the scroll, as Rabbi Sacks says, and Jonathan Sacks, and that we are, you know, kind of all have our roots back to receiving the commandments and the Torah at Mount Sinai. For me, I think I had a very, you know, familiar background for a lot of Jews in America who are culturally or ethnically Jewish but don't have real belief. And I think as a young adult, I came to the realization that if I were going to be Jewish, if I were going to kind of carry this mantle, then I needed to know what it meant to me. But it wasn't enough to be Jewish in any context if it didn't carry a real meaning. And that desire grew ever deeper as I got older, as I felt the sense of spiritual yearning, I felt the desire to study and grow in faith, that for me, I had to really understand what it was to be Jewish. And I think now, in terms of living at the intersection of identity and inspiration, which is to understand my cultural and ethnic identity as a Jew, but to also really forge that relationship with God and seek inspiration from God and seek, as the psalmists write, about seeking God's face and living with divine closeness. I think that though Jews tend, non-Orthodox Jews, tend not to speak of God very easily, I think it's such an important part of our theology to understand the desire to be close to God. And I think in some ways in the book and in my speaking about it, that I like to challenge, you know, both clergy and lay people in Judaism to think about that relationship with God. So that's, I think that was the inspiration for me. What gives me meaning? What gives me a sense of real belonging?
Your wife, Beth, serious person, highly accomplished woman, seemed like a fairly strong Methodist background. How did she respond initially to your idea that you wanted to have more faith in your home?
Well, she was the inspiration for it in many ways but I think at different levels. I think she started by saying, look, if we're going to do this, then you need to lead us on a spiritual path similar to what she grew up with. And that you have to know about your own faith. You have to know what you believe. I write in the book, she says, I know what you are, but what is it you believe? And I think that question for any Jew is very important because belief isn't always central to Jewish faith. And it was important to me. So I think she was satisfied that I was going on a path of learning and connection because it was similar to her own path, even if it was a different tradition. So I think, you know, she welcomed it. I think some of that tension is, you know, as I was initially going down a path, a more halachic path, where I was going down a path of more orthodox practice, not necessarily keeping kosher, but, you know, donning tefillin and learning with more orthodox scholars. And I learned with the modern orthodox scholar that there's a tendency, I think, for someone who has a spiritual awakening to identify with the more obviously religious people and think that that is the way. And I think that created some tension between us because that was almost alienating, you know, which was, I think she recognized it as something of a passage, not a permanent place, but she got a little bit uncomfortable with that, not wanting me to kind of go in a direction that wasn't a good fit for our entire family.
You have moved through a variety of different, I don't know, mentors might be the right term. You've explored these ideas with a variety of different people. Who did you find to be the most influential in your experience?
Well, I mean, the one that I would describe as my Rebbe is a woman named Erica Brown, who's an author and a Jewish educator in the Washington, Maryland area, who lectures around the country. She's just an extraordinary friend and teacher and mentor and kind of a guide for me spiritually, religiously, textually, and otherwise, as helping me kind of navigate the tradition and navigate my own kind of soul search. So she's truly been the most influential on me because of who she's connected me to and how she's thought about connecting me to different people. And she's recognized more of a spiritual yearning that I've had has introduced me to people who have a more Hasidic orientation, as well as, you know, people who might be working in philanthropy and otherwise. So, you know, she's been very strong. Rachel Cowan, who is a rabbi in New York, has also been very strong for me. And I think in terms of who I write about in the book, you know, it's interesting. I use the example of Joel Osteen because, I mean, why did I go to him? He's an evangelical preacher. And I had some reservations because I thought, well, you know, I'm going to ask him about how anyone goes about deepening their faith, what counsel he would provide. And I thought, you know, as a mainline Protestant preacher, you know, that he might say, look, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. And that's kind of the end and the beginning of the discussion. But that's not what he said. What he said to me was, I thought something that's actually really Jewish, which was, he said, I think what's important is to have a heart for God. To have a heart for God. And I really, I went away from his magnificent worship service really thinking about what it meant to have a heart for God, to have a kind of openness to God, an openness to oneness with God. And I thought, yeah, that speaks to me, and it's something that I carry around a great deal.
You know, it's fascinating. He could have quoted the Ve'ahavta, and he wouldn't have been far off.
Right, right.
I've always wondered about the commandment to love God. Because you can command people to do a lot of things, but commanding somebody to love, that's complicated.
It's so interesting because and even in the Ten Commandments, right, we are not commanded to love our parents.
Right.
We are commanded to honor our parents, and yet we are commanded to love God and understand that God loves us, right? In our morning verses of praise before the Shema, right. We talk about how God loves us.
Ahavah Rabbah, right, exactly.
Yeah, and it's so powerful. Yeah, really powerful.
Do you consider yourself a Reformed Jew now, if you had to have a label?
Yeah, I think my friend Erica says that I should consider myself post-denominational. I think I'm probably best situated institutionally in the Reform movement because of the choices that I've made in my life, right? I don't have a Jewish wife. I don't have a Jewish mother.
I don't think the mother was your choice, just, you know, throwing it out there.
Well, that's fair enough, right. But I mean, in terms of where
I understand.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. But so in terms of the space I occupy in the Jewish world. But I guess I'm a Reformed Jew, but I find myself kind of going deeper. I'm at the moment, I'm really interested in Hasidism and you know, that deeply spiritual path, mystical path in Judaism, which I find, it's interesting. You know, I've spent a lot of time trying to gain some understanding of Christianity and the Gospels, and I'm very inspired by various teachings, and whether it's Frederick Buechner or Thomas Merton or others, and I realize that keeps drawing me back into Judaism to look for sources that are similar, and when I find them, the discovery is so exciting because I realize that there's so much within our own tradition that can nourish me and also give me a sense of belonging because I feel a part of it.
Kind of a silly question. You're one of the tallest Jews out there, and you're the only one I know that President George W. Bush gave the nickname Stretch. Does that have any consequence when you walk into a shul?
Well, I mean, I think it does. It's a combination of things, being so tall and, you know, having an Irish punim, you know, and my father having changed his name from Ginsburg to Gregory. You know, in all seriousness, I mean, the sense of Jewish identity is one where, you know, to be a tall, kind of fair-skinned, red-haired boy named Gregory meant that nobody knew I was Jewish unless I said so. And that, you know, a sense of kind of being part of the community is always something I think I've always felt sort of on the outside, you know, because of a need to, a need to self-identify. So I do, when I speak in front of Jewish audiences, I inevitably say, you know, yes, I am. And everybody starts cracking up. And I said, I know, you know, and everybody turns to their person. You know, who knew, you know, and he's so tall. What kind of name is Gregory? You know, so...
Right.
There's always these questions.
It's a great pleasure fascinating book. The book is called How's Your Faith? An Unlikely Spiritual Journey by David Gregory. Strongly recommended. David, is there a website people can go to find out more?
Yeah, david-gregory.com has more information on the book and some of the things that I'm doing.
Thank you so much for a great visit, and we'll have to talk again. I'm curious about what's going to be the next chapter in this spiritual journey of yours.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, and I will say, Rabbi, I mean, I think one of the things that I'm interested in, even in my journalism, is a kind of, you know, the one thing I believe within our community, but not exclusive to our community, is that people are searching, you know, and what I think they're searching for is a language of spiritual connection and spiritual meaning and purpose. And one of the things I hope to do in sort of sharing these ideas, I'm not a faith leader, I'm not a you know, I'm a lay person, but just as a student and a seeker, is trying to help connect people to that language. It's been really fulfilling for me. And I think with the language, you can grow and you can really grow spiritually. And I think there's a great desire for that.
Thank you again. When we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Rabbi Abraham Cooper, the 2015 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award winner, the Associate Dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center and Tolerance Museum. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is the classic Yiddish folk song Tum Balalaika, sung by Chazan Vladimir Aronson. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.